you have an interesting past that we won't go into too much detail, but actually interested in knowing a certain event that happened to you at the beginning of this year that kind of brought you out of that past, and what it was and why it happened.
Sure. So yes, I started my career as a CIA analyst, worked throughout government in various different roles, but mostly a large chunk of my government role was in intelligence. Mm-hmm. And it's something I never really talked about publicly, not necessarily because I couldn't, I wasn't a covert operative or anything like that, but mostly because I didn't want to. Yep. I mean, there were times where obviously I couldn't talk about certain things anyway, but it was a personal choice. I kept my work life and personal life separate and didn't feel the need to advertise where I was working, and there were times where I wasn't allowed to. I did, as many people might have seen, after our presidential election, our current president's first act on day one was to give a speech at the headquarters of the CIA. And that moment particularly, that particular moment offended me so strongly, having a president stand in front of that wall of what's called the Wall of Honor, the stars mm-hmm. that represent fallen CIA officers, and make the kinds of statements he did, that it compelled me to actually speak out. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote an article in the New York Times about that particular event and why, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or conservative or liberal, why that matters, that it shouldn't have been a political event at all. And on that day, I pretty much told the world in the New York Times about my CIA past. But I felt it was important enough to recognize that I have a platform that gives me a place of credibility when I speak about these issues, and I didn't want to do so anonymously, because as much as I understand people who are still in government who speak anonymously, I recognize the power of being able to look at someone and say, this person is speaking from that place. Mm. And that matters, and that changes the dialogue. So it was important enough to me to do that.
So, I mean, I don't necessarily take your LinkedIn profile as gospel, but that, as far as I can tell from that, you actually stopped in sort of around 2013, and had some other work for a few years in between, or yes. Was it contracting work?
No. When I left, I would say completely reinvented myself. Mm-hmm. Again, I had an amazing government career. One that the highlights was really towards the end, where I got to serve Vice President Biden at the White House, and from there was really nowhere to go mm-hmm. but down after working for a man like that. So I decided it was time to leave government and really see what the private sector brings to bear mm-hmm. on some of these same challenges. So I actually went in-house, total 180, went in-house at ExxonMobil and worked on corporate social responsibility issues for 2 years at their headquarters.
Was that during? Oh, no, that was BP, wasn't it?
That had
What's that like? I mean, I would say oil companies probably have, depending on who's in power and in each end, so possibly even as bad reputation as government sometimes. Yeah. I mean, what was that like? Especially, I mean, you're working in kind of the best possible role, maybe, at an oil company.
Well, so it was important to me. If somebody had asked me when I was thinking of leaving government, if there was anything you could do, what would it be? Mm. And I had made this comment, not actually thinking it would ever happen. I said, I would love to go into one of these big, bad corporations with a huge presence, particularly in Africa, because I spent most of my career working in Africa. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I said, and I'd really love to help them think through a little better how they work with their local communities. Mm. You know, you can call it corporate social responsibility, you can call it corporate citizenship, you can call it a million things, but that was what I wanted to do. And I guess, you know, I said it, I put it out there in the world. A year later, someone sent me an email saying, well, ExxonMobil happens to be looking for someone to come in and help them look at the impact of their programs around the world, help quantify the impact and all of that. And I paused. I definitely paused. It's ExxonMobil. Yeah. There's everything that comes with that. But I strongly, strongly believe that instead of standing on the outside and complaining about something that you don't actually know firsthand, I believe in going inside and seeing what the realities are and what positive role I can play in it. So
it's actually, I mean, at a very small scale, my wife and I used to run an environment charity in Australia, and we actually found some of our best programs and partnerships, but generally with corporates.
It's
a bit of an unsung secret, actually, that most charities, especially, I'm not sure if it's the same the world over, but there anyway, you actually end up making a lot of your income from corporate responsibility programs and things, because they're the best places really to kind of, maybe you have less of a, maybe you have less of an impact as an organization, but you actually possibly accomplish more in the long run. I'm not sure.
It's really interesting. Yeah. I went in there, it was a very new field for me. And the first thing that you do is sort of benchmark across industries. Mm. And I have to say, I'm no apologist for the oil and gas industry. I'm no apologist for mistakes of the past. But I was very impressed with how thoughtful ExxonMobil was about their corporate, I mean, if you want to call it philanthropy, it's much more of a partnership the way they work programs. But I was really impressed with how thoughtful it was. And they, again, this is definitely not an advertisement for the company, but they...
I don't know if they really need anybody.
But they do have some really impressive, thoughtful work around the world that kept me there for 2 years. It was interesting enough to me and meaningful enough that I stayed on.
And then since I've seen, you've sort of been doing like risk advisory...
Yeah. So
what does that mean exactly?
Sure. So I moved to New York about 2 years ago now. First and foremost, I'm a New Yorker by attitude. Okay. So I just wanted to be back in New York, first and foremost.
You feel at home in a city that could be more rude than New York.
More rude and more lovely at the same time. Oh, but so I went into a firm that does, I mean, they do a variety of things, but it's really... I was heading the political risk practice for this firm, and that can be a whole variety of things, from helping companies figure out how to acquire licenses overseas without engaging in corrupt practices, who they need to work with to make sure they're doing things in an above board way, or a startup or a company or a firm that wants to work in an emerging market and doesn't quite know who to work with, how to do it, how to do it well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a way, let's be honest, it's a bit of corporate intelligence in a way. But what really drew me to that firm was really the anti-corruption angle of it, because I thought, to me, that was something that was positive and a good way to help companies do well overseas without engaging in bad practices.
So before we started, before I switched on the mic, you said to me that you're not really a tech person, and yet we're at a conference called Tech Open Air, which if anyone doesn't know, I mean, I'm looking out the window and I can see tents and music stages, and so it's not the most traditional tech conference anyway.
It's a festival.
But so what are you here to speak about?
So, you know, when I first got the invitation, I remember smiling, thinking I'm not quite sure where I fit into this program. But as I've been thinking about it more, there are a few key messages. I think, you know, I'm doing a fireside chat tomorrow, and I know a lot of it will just be a little bit more of the personal, why, who are you, why did you do this? But I have two really key messages I hope to get across. And one of them is, you know, in any of these major global challenges, any of them, you know, for me, I worked a lot on counter-extremism and counter-terrorism for most of my career. But whether it be counter-extremism, whether it be climate change, whether it be the refugee crisis, any of these things, right, governments can't do it alone and shouldn't do it alone. Mm-hmm. And I think the tech industry in particular has the capability of really playing positive role in tackling some of these challenges and contributing in a certain way. And I hope to get across this message of what the tech industry's roles can be and how you can continue to advance your product while also having a positive impact. I mean, I have examples, and for me, for example, one of the biggest issues, and I'm sure we'll talk about this at some point, is we all know about the filter bubbles and all these things. But I think the tech industry has this really interesting role that they could be playing, and are, many are, in how to really help advance solutions to some of these problems.
The tech bubble is something, filter bubble is, well, possibly the same. So it was interesting because, I mean, if we go back before the... And I'm not going to go into any detail on these. It's just as a point.
Sure.
Before the Snowden revelations, people thought that people who talked about being spied on were just tinfoil hat wearing. And then the Snowden revelations happened, and everyone suddenly was, some of these people were right. And there was a similar thing I felt with the filter bubble, that lots of people talked about it, but then it actually took some very public events of the past 6 months for people to go, oh, actually, there's repercussions. So I think it's interesting because in some ways technology has been a great savior for people who always felt different, especially in smaller communities where you would often possibly be the only person who had a particular interest or a particular lifestyle or whatever it may be. And then in the past decades, you've been able to connect with other like-minded people around you. But then something happened in the past few years where it kind of got too extreme.
Yeah.
And the tech industry has become obsessive with crafting algorithms that serve you exactly what you want, which works fantastically in some places, but has caused a bit of a large negative knock-on effect. And I suppose, do you have any thoughts or advice for some of these companies on how they can continue to kind of deliver these tailored products, but not blinker people to other alternatives? And I mean, it's a broad spectrum, from recommending brands of toilet paper on Amazon. It's not necessarily connected to Facebook only kind of presenting you news from people who have the same opinion as you, but they're sort of part of the same issue.
Right. And
do you have any recommendations for the companies how they can somehow get a balance between the two?
So, there's so many thoughts I'm going to unpack in this. I mean, first of all, I unfortunately don't have the tech background to know exactly what they can do, but I do know that, you know, I had about a year ago, actually before I really admit to my CIA past, the first time I wrote was really a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can read between the lines. I do mention that I had an Intel background in that piece.
Yeah, yeah.
But I talk about how I thought that the biggest threat, at least in the US, what I felt was the biggest threat was no longer the threat of foreign terrorists, but it was the threat of Americans who are so polarized that they absolutely refuse to talk to people who are on the opposite side of any issue, right? So I look at this and there's this never-ending debate. Is it Facebook's responsibility to make sure that they're showing you content from all over? It's not their responsibility, but when they are purposely creating algorithms that are making sure that you don't see the other side, that to me is extremely problematic. Mm. I mean, I would challenge folks to really ask themselves, am I willing to work with people who are not like-minded? Am I willing to engage with people who are not like-minded? Because more and more, the answer seems, or I don't know about today, but 6 months ago, the answer was pretty clear that it was no. People were self-segregating into communities of like-minded people, right? Whether that be in physical spaces, choosing their neighborhoods, their schools, their social environments, but definitely online. And here we've got this the internet, which should be a tool to unite people, to connect people, to expose people.
To a certain point.
Something switched. But that's a human tendency as well, right? It's a human tribal tendency to go towards people who are like you.
Yeah.
And what I want to really challenge people to think about is, if you want to play a role in solving any, whether it's a local problem or a global problem, you have to be willing to talk to people who have different opinions than you. Mm. Every major success in my career, and obviously, unfortunately, I can't talk about extreme details, but I can say, including one that led to rescuing a life, a human being, it was because over a few years, I had been willing to sit down with people who were on the complete opposite from me, suspected terrorists, extremists,
and then often radical shame.
And then, you build a trust. Yeah. And even if you don't agree, you build enough trust that when I needed that person or those people a year or two later to help me possibly save a life, they trusted me enough to talk to me again. And it's just, this is my biggest concern with this proliferation of, I mean, I'm probably not going to say this in the correct technical terms because I'm not that person, but just this proliferation of technologies and algorithms and data that are bringing people together with only other like-minded people. And, and you know, I'm a lefty, I'm a liberal, but does that mean that I don't sit down and recognize that me and the person on the right side of that issue, right, as in directional, right, don't both have at the end of the day a common interest to solve the issue, even if we don't agree on politics or religion or ideology or whatever? And the only way we're going to solve that problem is if we both figure it out. And I love being at festivals like this. I do find that obviously at a festival like this, you often find people who very much only talk to their cohorts and to people who think like they do.
Yeah.
And I really want to challenge them to get outside that box and recognize that they will only really advance the needle on any issues if they're willing to widen that. And that, and that's where things like the filter bubble, it happened. Great. Facebook, mea culpa. We recognize we actually created algorithms.
Yeah.
What are you going to do now?
And the feeling is I get from a lot of, I mean, I've been to a lot of startup events, and I'm going to say startup event more than tech event.
Okay.
Because I think tech events tend to be much more just people focusing on how they accomplish certain things, whatever that may be, whereas the startup events are more about the ideas and the products and things like that. It seemed to be like, oh, yeah, we've got this problem. We're going to solve it with more algorithms. And it seems to me somewhat like, hang on a minute. This doesn't seem right. So, you know, fight fire with fire and all that. But I think it's an algorithm that sort of got us here in the first place. And this, especially when I see with things like artificial intelligence and automation and robots, it's like people stand up on a stage and they say, well, you know, we're inventing this technology that's going to get rid of a lot of jobs. And at some, and you sit there thinking, but you're okay with that? I mean,
exactly.
or it's almost like, yeah, we know this is going to cause lots of problems in 20 years, but we're going to do it anyway. And you're like, okay. It's like, have you thought about this?
So that brings up something.
Just constantly innovating for the hell of it.
And I was speaking to a few people last night about this. Of course, I may be considered the cynic or the annoying person here because I'm always going to ask those questions.
But somebody was
talking to me about this very cool technology that she was bringing, making more accessible to more communities. And I challenged her on that. You know, this is incredible. I completely understand the amazing advancements that this technology is going to bring. And I know this is not your responsibility, but you do realize in the near term, this is going to end up destroying so many jobs. And I get it. You can give me the example of, well, during the agricultural revolution or the industrial revolution. Yeah, but those things happen at a much slower pace. Mm. And people, yes, we will survive at the end of the day. This is going to happen at such a fast pace. We will have people in their 40s and 50s who you can say all you want, but now this will free them to go find their true creative passion.
Yeah.
No, this will make them
and
jobless.
Society,
and that's,
but won't move as quickly.
That's right. And I get it. It's not your responsibility to it. And politics has failed us because politicians will never campaign on a platform of, I'm not going to bring back any of your jobs, but I'm campaigning on a platform of saying, I'm going to help figure out how to retrain you for the future.
Yeah.
No one will vote for that person.
Oh, yeah.
So while it's not a tech startup's role to think about, well, what do I do to make sure people aren't losing their jobs? I would offer, okay, but have you thought about, this is where I actually, this is another thought of mine of trying to redefine the term of corporate social responsibility, right?
Yeah, actually, yes.
If you're a tech firm and you're bringing out this amazing technology that is going to advance whatever it is, let's look at, I mean, anything. Automation is such an easy one. Let's look at automatic driving, you know, vehicles and the truck. I didn't know this. The truck driving industry in the U.S. apparently is the biggest employer.
Yeah.
And if
it's
you,
pretty
if
here too.
Every truck driver loses their job, that might not be you who's creating self-driving cars' responsibility. But why not make that your corporate social responsibility platform? Why not say, and at the same time, we are going to redirect even just 1% of our efforts to job training throughout the country for truck drivers for a new sort of industry. Call that your social good.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to know they're doing a social good. Great. You're creating this game-changing technology. Also think about the social impact and make that your publicly braggable corporate social responsibility strategy.
Yeah.
But then that also brings me back to, now I'm really getting on my soapbox.
It's all right.
This idea of, one of the things, I'm not going to name names, but I got a little bit, I mean, frightened's an overstatement, but yesterday somebody was speaking and this person was talking about all these amazing things that young tech innovators can create and was giving an example of someone who was in their young 20s who created this game-changing technology. And he said, so clearly experience doesn't matter. And I thought, okay, experience doesn't matter to create that technology.
Yeah.
But experience matters if you want to bring in someone who has worked on these issues in the real world and sit down and talk to them about, but what is the real human impact here? And how can you help me think through all of the risks that will come out of this and what we can do? And that human life experience matters.
Work experience, but life experience. And I think, I mean, the slogan of our podcast is, and that's a whole other topic. Myself and my co-host are 36 plus. So, you know, it's interesting because an industry that generally focuses on the young, but I think one of the advantages of the tech in commerce industry is that it can be moderately anonymous as well. So sometimes it only comes only in the sort of final stages when you meet someone face to face do they actually realize how old you might be. But I think it's going to be, I don't think we're going to get into territory of Logan's Run or anything like that quite yet. But, you know, it could sometimes be, I met some people yesterday who were working in the innovation department of a major German corporate here, and they looked like they were about 15. And I just, I'm sort of, and you can't but help sometimes feel like, oh my God, I must look really ancient here. And you're really not. But I think there's actually an increased recognition that people who have been around longer bring different sorts of experience. Diversity is not just gender and race; it's all sorts of things,
right.
And it's something that is partially being recognized.
I mean, there's so many things that I'm trying not to use really obvious examples, but I'm sure at some point I will. As we know, any little thing can also destroy a company right now in the age of social media, in the age of people jumping, you know, that tribal mentality, jumping all in to attack someone if they do something you don't agree with. I mean, the perfect example in the U.S. when Uber surged their vehicles to JFK Airport after the quote Muslim ban. I don't think that Uber thought, we hate Muslims, let's exploit the situation.
Yeah.
But because people already didn't trust this company because of previous
experience,
corporate sort of culture issues, they all, I mean, that, and in the end, we'll see if that will really affect Uber or not. But the reason I bring that example up is if you would sat down, and it's interesting because they have very serious people on their board.
Yeah.
But if you would sit down and listen to the advice of people who have worked really hard in these worlds, you might have been able to avoid some of that by actually understanding that making sure the public knows where your corporate values lie is important. Yeah. And maybe I shouldn't say my age on this podcast. I'm 22. No, I mean, I'm in my 40s, so I'm already retired according to the guy who gave the speech yesterday. But we continue to say, only when you engage, I mean, now I sound like I'm pitching myself, which is not what I mean, but only when you engage people who have actually been on the ground, worked on these issues to remind you that there's a human aspect to every single thing you're doing and to help you think through that side of it, will you be able to be completely successful, assuming that part of your success, you want to know that you're also contributing in a positive way instead of a negative way to humanity. If that's not one of your issues, then, you know, I guess you don't need to talk to people with experience. But at the end of the day, your business will not succeed.
I think if I had a camera, then it would have picked up the very nice eye roll in the middle of that sentence.
Don't tell them I rolled my eyes.
Well, I think we only get half an hour just because other people want to use the room. Which is fair enough. We should also be fair. But I think that's a very nice place to end anyway. I mean, maybe just on the much more practical, just wrap up. What are you doing at the moment? What's next? What's your plans?
So I have three major... I've never been that person who has a five-year plan.
No.
And yet I've had a pretty successful career. But I do have three major goals right now.
Yeah.
One, I mean, I'm going to start teaching at NYU in the fall, graduate-level courses on national security stuff. I'm very excited about that. I want to continue to inspire especially younger women to get into the foreign policy and national security world because we need it.
Yep.
So there's that. Secondly, one of my number one passions right now is about playing my role in helping I mean, this is very U.S. focused, but helping get back to a place where civil discourse is accepted and can happen. So that's just a personal, really big goal for me. And then third, working with companies as an advisor. You know, I'm on retainer with a few, helping companies, startups, whoever, nonprofits as well, think through any of, I mean, mostly a lot of the ones I work with work in emerging markets, but anywhere, and just really thinking through their whole range of risks, both socially and actual risks, whether they be anti-corruption risks, political risks, helping make sure that companies really, a lot of them, the things they're not thinking about, keep them out of trouble, as opposed to come ask me after you've gotten into trouble. So those are the three things. One is the obvious consulting side of it. Yeah. The other two are my passions. I'm excited to teach, and I am completely focused on trying to help foster more civil discourse right now.